Welcome to Executives After Hours, real conversations with real leaders. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. I want to make you a promise that over the next 60 minutes, you will learn at a minimum two things. One, every leader and executive makes mistakes on the way to the top. And two, and more importantly, everyone has a unique story to tell. And that's what we do here on Executive After Hours. We sit down with leaders across a variety of industries, and we talk to them about their unique story. So welcome to the community, and stay tuned for today's episode on your Executives After Hours. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Executives After Hours 2018 edition. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. For those of you who are listening over the holiday break, I hope you enjoyed the University of Western Australia Diversity and Inclusion series that I had the pleasure to be the host of. It was a great opportunity for myself, and what a fantastic learning experience. So I hope you enjoyed that. You can always check out UWA at www.uwa.edu.au. That's my PhD alma mater, so very, very happy to be part of that process. So what I want to do today in this opening, since it is the first one for me in 2018, is to do a quick look back, because I didn't really do a recap, a quick look forward to where we're going, and any other nonsense that comes up in between there. So in thinking about 2017, professionally, I'm using this year, or I guess last year, as a transition year. And I've been very lucky through the podcast to meet a lot of just great people, just amazing people. And with that, I was encouraged and I decided to write this book, as you all know all too well, about the Crucible's gift, where our adversity really plays into where we're going and how we lead better. As I started to, I gave my first presentation on this in December at something called Creative Mornings. And it's a global event that happens every month around the world, different cities. I was lucky to be able to talk about the death of leadership, death, and my perspective on it, thinking about how you should lead based on your adversity, not instead of your adversity, if that makes sense. Embrace it, use it, grow from it. But, 2017 for me was this reflection on where I want to go in my career and what I want to do in 2018, 2019. And one of the things you learn in life, and you try to teach your kids if you have kids, and if you don't, I'm sure you're going through this yourself, is that there's no substitute for hard work. There's no substitute for patience and persistence and stick-to-itiveness or any other verb that you would like to put into that defines just staying the course. And you see this when you interview a lot of executives. You see this if you listen to a lot of interviews, people who are super successful. You've got the 5% who overnight, at least it appears overnight, and maybe for some of them there are. But the other 95% of us, it's bust our ass. We work really hard to get where we're trying to go. And there's no guarantees in life. There's no promises. There's no you're going to get it because you worked hard. But it's my belief that if you work hard and you're a good person, eventually, somewhere down the road, it will pay off if you are truly following the path you're supposed to be on. So for 2017, for me, it was really about setting up 2018. And as you all know, as I said earlier, the book coming out, The Crucible's Gift, 5 Lessons from Authentic Leaders Who Thrive in Adversity, is now due out April 23rd. So really excited about that. And so if you are annoyed from my marketing now, just wait, because over the next 3 months, it's going to ramp up even more so. The thing about writing a book is the writing the book is actually the easy part. It's the marketing of the book that's the most important part. And there's a lot of theories about why people write business books nowadays. For most people, it's not really about the book. It's about what happens after the book and if the message resonates with people. Or a larger audience, if you will. And for me, it was really about both. The book was very cathartic. The book was something that had been ruminating in my mind for such a long time that it felt great to put that idea down. And I already have another book already on the horizon. And, you know, that will start in 2 years. But before we even get there, you know, I've got to do the marketing. I've got to get it out. And for me, writing the book was about having an impact. And for many people, it's not necessarily true. It's about the speaking engagements and the consulting dollars and things like that. But I kind of feel like if I'm going to put my name on something, it's got to mean something. It's got to – I think you can sense the books you read that aren't really about the greater good. It's about the next thing. And so as I wrote this book, it definitely was about the greater good, which hopefully leads to greater things. And so as you read the book and you start seeing excerpts come out, excerpts? I think that's the right word. I think I'm saying it wrong. As they come out, hopefully you'll see my passion and you'll hear my voice in it. So over the next 3 months, there will be a ton of marketing, videos. I'm going to start reading just small, like one or two pages out of the book, kind of discussing each section so you can get a sense of what the book is about. And when it goes on pre-sale, which I think is going to be February, late February, I will definitely be sending that link out. So 2018 for me is going to be just a crazy year with the podcast, with the book. And in the summer, for an insanity check, I'm going to put myself, my wife, and 4 kids in a minivan starting on the East Coast, and we're going to drive and camp and do a book tour across America this summer, starting late June through August. God help me. This will be a tremendous bonding experience for our family, and it would be an insanity check for myself. But the aim of it is to experience the U.S., go to the major parks with my kids so they can have a once-in-a-lifetime experience, at least with the family, and then also go on podcasts, TV shows, radio shows, and hopefully do a full-blown book tour as I go across. So that's going to be 2018 for me. Also, for those of you who follow me a little bit, I've started actually cutting up a presentation I did called Creative Mornings, which I spoke about earlier, and this goes on around the world. I spoke about the death of leadership, and this was a 35-minute presentation, which was the first time I've actually talked about my book in a public setting. I mean, outside the podcast, but you know, when you do the podcast, you don't really feel as if you're talking to anybody, really. Like right now, I just feel like I'm talking to a mic. This was the first time I actually presented the topic, so. You know, this is a rough, but I want to get it out there. You know, I don't mind putting the wrong foot forward. That's the wrong expression. I don't mind if the work I put out isn't perfect every time, because I think that sometimes perfection is the enemy of done. And so I want to get this out there, and I will refine this presentation as I go and I go and I go. But I want you to see it. So I broke this talk up into 8 parts: an introduction, the setup. And then I'm going to start going through the different actual concepts of the book in the video. So you'll see them. 4 of them have rolled out, I think, at this point when this comes out, on LinkedIn and Twitter and Facebook and all that. And you can also go to my website to get the other video, you know, the other parts of the video as well. So be on the lookout for that. I'm also, you know, starting in February, going to do another video series with a little bit more depth. From the book as well, to give you another sense of what the book is really about. And so that's kind of what's going on for me in 2018. I mean, it's going to be super insane. And I also want to remind you that I also will start doing blog posts. And please subscribe. Go to my website and just subscribe so you get this stuff automatically as it gets posted. You know, and then I can put you on my mailing list and you can get this in your inbox. You don't have to go search for it, and it can save you a step as well. So, all right, that's kind of a long, long intro. So just quickly about today's guest. Today's guest is Marcus Dumas. He is the founder of Fueled by Culture. You know, Marcus is an ex-professional basketball player. He spent a couple years in Sweden playing, graduated from Townsend. He is the most chilled out dude ever, really relaxed. And so I was kind of not sure how he was taking my personality at times. You know, obviously I'm a bit more gregarious, loud, probably slightly obnoxious to those who don't know me. And he was just very chilled and relaxed. But Marcus's organization has really taken off in the last 10 or 12 months. I mean, he's working with some major brands, Lyft, Avion Water. And what they really do is they try to match the brands up with influencers in the market. And so he has clients that he works with. And so anyhow, it's a really interesting model. So check it out, Fueled by Culture and Marcus's company. And remember, you can also get the extended version on my website. You know, and it's great. You know, we talk about basketball and its influence. We talk about race and some different aspects of race. You know, I love race, the conversation of race, and some other tidbits. So go check out the website to get the full length interview if you want. Anyhow, so today's episode is Mr. Marcus Damas. I did this last time. Damas. I kill it every time. It's so bad. I'm so bad at phonetics. At the end of the day, go to Fueled by Culture. Marcus is an amazing guy, super chilled out, and awesome. So, all right, everyone, have a great day, and I will talk to you later. See you! All right, today on Executives After Hours, this individual kind of fell in my lap last week, as a matter of fact. And so this is kind of a really sudden interview, but man, super excited to have him on. And he is the CEO of Fueled by Culture. And so I want to say welcome to Marcus Damas. Did I get that
yes,
right?
Yes, yes, yeah.
Yes! High five. Thank you. I can swig my beer now in comfort. So, Marcus, thank you for coming on the show. I really appreciate your time and energy to sit down with me. How are you today?
I'm doing well, James. Thanks for having me.
No drama. So, you know, I always like to start with everyone who comes on my show just some sort of backdrop for my audience. So can you just kind of give the 10,000-foot view of where you're at and what you're currently doing?
Yeah, definitely. So I founded a creative marketing agency by the name of Fueled by Culture. We found most of our success in influencer and experiential marketing. We have clients, a short list of clients of Lyft, Postmates, Avion, and EA Sports, to name a few.
All right, so that was well delivered and well scripted. So I love it. One of the things you'll figure out pretty quickly about me, Marcus, is that I'm like Doug from Nice Guys on Business, super chill.
Yeah.
And so I'm just gonna roll with it. And so one of the things, you know, in the brief history that I could find about you is that, you know, you kind of talk about you come from humble beginnings, right? And this is this great Forbes article that just came out. Like, when did this come out? I think it was September 11th, so about a month and a half ago,
yeah.
In Forbes, that came out about you. And so what did you mean by humble beginnings?
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, it's kind of just how it sounds, right? I came from both of my parents are immigrants from Haiti. They came here when they were a little younger, about 10, in the range of 10 to 15. So we were first, I'm a first generation American, and just learning things at, I like to say I'm down 20 points every day I wake up, you know? So that's kind of my humble beginnings. We didn't have everything that, you know, we didn't have a million resources, but, it was, you know, it's a great lesson. I wouldn't change anything about the way I grew up just because I learned how to do without.
So where was it you grew up at?
Actually, Long Island. Long Island, Bayshore, Long Island, actually.
Mm-hmm. So what did your parents do from a career or job standpoint?
My mom, she's currently doing some accounting. And my father actually owns a tow trucking company. So they've jumped some hurdles and set a great example for me.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think what's really great about this story is I interviewed a guy a while back. Gosh, it must have been last fall. And his mom and dad were from the Caribbean. And he was first generation in the U.S. as well. And we started kind of going down this conversation about having multiple identities. And so as you're growing up, and I called it like cultural switching. And so as you were growing up, did you have like this Haitian culture, black culture, white culture? Like, were you able to kind of navigate that and kind of switch attributes and features of yourself depending on who you were around?
Well, I was always myself. I was, just to be honest, like always like myself to the point where, you know, you knew what you were going to get when it came to me. I was very enthralled in my culture and I was proud of it. In a time where not many of my people were proud of, you know, being where they were from. You know, now that's changed. However, I've always been proud of who I was, and not to say that the people who navigate aren't proud, but it was always great to connect the two or connect with somebody from where I come from. Like, hey, you like this kind of food? Well, my family makes this kind of food, you know? or you believe in that? Like, this is what I believe in. And there's usually a commonality. But this power in telling your story and just owning it, really.
So what is it like? I mean, you know, you've mentioned your mom a couple of times, and obviously your brother you're really close to, and your sister. You know, in my mind, your mom is like the strong figure that almost formed a lot of who Marcus is.
Definitely, definitely.
Yeah. And so,
my mom's a breast cancer survivor. So,
how old were you when that happened?
I was about 15.
Do you remember what that was like when you first found out?
Yeah, it was shocking. I mean, I just started playing basketball and I was, you know, picking it up, and immediately at that time I didn't have that much knowledge on cancer or breast cancer, so I thought I might lose my mom. Mm-hmm. And otherwise, you know, I really can't explain it, but it was just like mind blowing.
So, like, you know, 15, I'm sure it's pretty hard to get your head around, especially as someone who's so central in your life. You know, I can only imagine. And obviously she's a survivor at this point, so there's tons to celebrate.
Yeah.
So as your mom is going through this process, you know, I mean, you clearly have a strong opinion for your mom, but how did your affinity and respect change? If that makes sense. Do you know what I mean? Like,
that makes sense. Yeah. So my mom, it's mind blowing how she would come home and still be the same woman she was going through chemotherapy. And she would just always still find the energy for us and stay involved in everything that we had going on. And it's really just, you think you're down, right? And you any problem that you have day to day that are regular problems, you know, there's people that go through things 10 times over, yeah, and they still find that energy to get things done.
Yeah, it puts shit in perspective real quick, doesn't it? Even at 15, 16.
Exactly.
So, all right. So, I mean, you come from this great family, which has obviously set Marcus up for where you're at now. But you know, you obviously had some other aspects of your life. And I think for me, someone who played college sports, not basketball, I'm awful at that sport. That's not true. I'm not awful. I'm just very white and very slow.
Right.
But and jumping, man, if I got 3 inches, that was a great day for me. but I played water polo in college. So for me, okay, I understand to some level the intensity of college sports. So, you know, you said that you just started playing basketball at 15, which is quite late when you think about basketball in today's, you know, culture in the U.S. Did you just start playing because you were growing tall or because you had an affinity for it, or how did you end up?
No, I loved basketball. I just wasn't, I played a lot of street ball. When I say 15, it was my first time playing organized. But there's a huge difference.
Yeah.
I'm sure, you know, right? Like playing in the street, there were certain things I didn't know that the common person, I didn't know. I experienced my first layup line, which is very fundamental. Yeah, right? In basketball.
That's like, 15. That's when you're 6 years old trying to figure that out.
Exactly. Exactly. So things, you know, I think it was a good starting point, right? Cause everything in life, if you see the people who I've surpassed in basketball, they've been playing forever.
You know, when you started playing organized basketball and learning what a layup line is, what did your coaches like? Because I always in my head feel like someone who grew up playing street ball versus organized ball is almost harder. It's almost trying to get like the wild horse off of the ranch trying to like corral them into doing like being a show horse. So what was your challenges of like trying to go through and it actually participate, I guess, in organized basketball without pissing everybody off?
No, I pissed everybody off early. It was just just like understanding terminologies like defensive schemes and just things of that nature, even understanding offenses. But I figured it out, man. So
yeah, but I mean, like again, I don't know if this is true or not, but this is probably me from watching ridiculous movies that glorify it. But I feel like streetball is a fairly selfish form of basketball. I don't know if that's fair to say or not.
Yeah, definitely. Like, it's all about yourself.
And so
it's all about scoring.
And you're 6'7". I don't know. I mean, you obviously weren't 6'7" at 15, but I mean, I'm imagining you were probably one of the – were you a late bloomer or were you
– No. I was always one of the tall guys.
And so, like, probably at 15, 16, at 6'7", you were probably 6'3", 6'4". You were probably either playing small forward or power forward at that age, you know, being that tall, that young. So
see, that was one of the things about me. I knew what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a guard, a tall guard.
Okay.
So that's one of the things the coaches hated about me, because I didn't have the skills to dribble, and I really wasn't the best shooter, but I would just do it anyway. And I got really good at it. So I would recommend it to anyone.
So basically what you're saying is don't listen to your coaches. Play street basketball until you're 15, become really selfish, and then I'm just messing with you.
Right. But I manifested it, though. I definitely
did. How did you manifest that stubborn behavior? Like did you outwork people? Did you out-hustle people? Like, how did you, you know, you got the Townsend, which we can talk about in a second, but how did you, through those early years, decide that you were going to be that person, that guard, and excel at it?
Just watching TV, man. It was I was really a thing of I wanted to be the best, and all the best were like guards, you know, unless you were Shaq, and I was a skinny guy. So I really just knew I had to either dribble or be a great shooter, so I wanted to do both. And that's what really drove me, man.
And so did your work ethic develop from your family or through basketball or both?
From both. Just seeing my father, like, waking up every morning. My dad has a bad back, but he was just like, he had to go get it, freezing cold regardless. Just out there, you know, by himself, towing cars, moving stuff.
What was his attitude like?
You know, that's
like?
Just like
– like, I'm just always – because like, you seem like such a mellow dude, like just chilled the F out. And so like I don't know if that's the island culture, which could be. But also in my mind, I think like did you have these positive people? Like your mom obviously was pretty positive. But did your dad also have that sense of like do your job but do it with a smile?
Yeah, my dad's like very personable. Definitely get my personality from him.
So yeah. how do you find different ways to connect with people? Like, what's your trick? What's your trade?
You know, usually now in the business world, if that's what we're talking, I usually do my research, so I know that I know about the person before I connect with them, or you know, I use like the trending topics. I use sports. I use just different commonalities that you would find that connects deeper with people where you're from.
So it sounds like what you do, and this is something that, you know, this is a great shameless plug for me. for my book coming out in the spring, I write a chapter about relatableness, and that people who are really successful in leadership find a way to create shared meaning with whomever they're talking to. And so for you when you're in high school, it was like, ooh, that the stuff is nasty. But as a professional, now you're trying to find ways by doing research to figure out where you guys are common. And that's where the conversation starts out of. That's what it sounds like to me. Is that kind of, did I get that or?
Exactly that. Yeah. Exactly that.
It's a really important trait, because I think that too often when people start a conversation, they start from where they're at. And they don't think about where the other person's at. And the reality is, if you can figure out where they're at, it's so much easier to bridge that gap. Because you're speaking their language from the start. It's so like you're playing basketball and you're crushing it at Townsend. What's the conversation like come your senior year for you? Because I feel like this would be a really interesting conversation. You know, you're a tall guard, which means you're probably on the radar for many people. And so, like, what's that conversation coming out of your senior year for you?
I'm just really trying to figure out what's next, right? Because as soon as I graduated, life hit me. You know, everything became real, and as soon as I graduated, so just the conversation was where do I want to play? What agent do I want to work with? And we knew I wasn't going to get drafted, so it was just pretty much what's the route to the NBA, mm-hmm. the quickest route, or even the route to grab money early. So it's kind of what I wanted to do.
You know, you always hear almost every athlete that comes into D1 says, "Hey, I want to make it to the NBA," which you should say that if you're going to D1 and that's, you know, you're going to exactly. school. But at what point does reality hit you and say, "Okay, maybe I'm not NBA, but maybe I'm X"? Or did you ever think that? Like, did you ever think like maybe I'm not quite skilled enough? Or
no, I still think I can play in the NBA today. There's no discredit. That's, you know, to credit those guys, they're the best at what they do. They're, you know, but I also felt like I was really good. However, the route to the NBA wasn't one I was prepared to take. Might have been a little longer. Mm-hmm. I felt a bit out of control in this process because politics are involved, sure. and when there's politics involved, you know, the variable of you having the best skill or being really good didn't.
So where do you go then from town? Do you go, is that where you went to Sweden straight away?
Yeah.
So what was it like for you in Sweden?
Oh, it was amazing, man. It was a cultural difference. I learned a lot. Culturally.
You think it's a cultural difference?
No, yeah. Definitely. You'd be surprised. I didn't go there expecting them to be very fashionable. I didn't go there expecting it to be so beautiful out there. And so it was just like, it was a culture shock.
So really. What did you think before you went? I think this is always a great example of like perception and reality. So like, what did you think you were going to see when you got off the airplane? Like the people and all that?
Yeah, first of all, I didn't think there'd be nice people there. And I thought it'd be racist, but it was the opposite. Really, like I didn't experience any racism before they even knew I played basketball. And then after they knew I played basketball, it was, you know, even even better experience. The city, I was right outside the city of Stockholm. So I got to experience some great restaurants. It was amazing over there, man. I wish I could go back. Well, I can with my family. But.
So you were there 2 years, 3 years?
Two.
Two. So. I guess the two questions I have immediately is, you know, someone who's lived multiple different places around the world, I always think that every place you live gives you an opportunity to learn something about yourself. So what did you learn about Marcus when you're living in this foreign country?
Yeah, so, you know, Marcus, one, you know, and you discovered it earlier while we were speaking, but, you know, Marcus is a family guy, and Marcus I don't really do well without my family nearby. My family is like my engine. You know, I'm the body, they're the engine. So that's just me. You know, some people do really well without their family, but I was just like, you know, I was better off with my family next to me. My wife today was in New York. My mom was in New York. My father, my brother, everybody was in New York. And I can only speak to them sometimes. The hours were different. I think it was a 7-hour difference. Mm-hmm. So I only got to speak to them 2 hours out of the day, 3 hours, maybe one, when that, you know, you factor in practice and games.
So, all right, let's talk about your company, Fueled by Culture. And we'll just spend 10 or 15 minutes max on this, maybe 10. And just tell me where the concept came from. And man, you've just blown up really quick with what you're doing.
Yeah,
So tell me where it came from and why you're passionate about it. And kind of what's going on, where's it going?
Yeah, so it came from, I was doing some work at EA Sports after I decided not to play directly after. And my agent at the time got me that consulting job at EA Sports. And it pretty much came down to me doing what I'm doing now, which is connecting like influencers and celebrities with the brand and just helping them get the brand off the ground, which is NBA Live. So in parallel to doing that, you know, I saw a clear space in the market and a need, and I stepped away for a second and kept them on as a client and moved on to start Fueled by Culture. And you know, I just applied that same knowledge and that same experience to other brands like Lyft, Postmates, Avion, and EA as well.
So, but what do you think it is about you, right? I mean, like you said earlier, there's 1,000 people trying to do what you're doing. So what is it about you?
I'm a huge people person, and I add value. I know how to connect with everyone because time is the most important thing, right? If you're going to ask for somebody's time, you got to figure out how to add them value. And that's the first, you know, thing I come with is value when I approach someone. It could be anyone, you name it. I'll figure out how to, you know, have lunch with Michael Jordan probably in the next year.
But what value do you bring then? I mean, that seems like a ridiculous question, I guess, but I'm just curious because you throw the word around.
It's very situational, right? I'll tell you, somebody, I think we both know he is, Gary Vaynerchuk.
Yeah.
He's a man that's very hard to reach, right? And I know that Gary's a huge basketball fan, and he likes growth and just talking to people who are doing amazing things. So I connected him with a few people without me being there, a few other influencers, and just, you know, like, hey, you know, with the head nod and the tip of the hat. And then the third time I connected him with my best friend, who is Tobias Harris. Mm-hmm. And I went there as well with him. And from then on, Gary and I has been, you know, we've been in touch, and I work very closely with his team, and we have good rapport. So that's just one example of, you know, I knew what drove him and mm-hmm. what pushed the needle for him, and I just went full force with it.
So that's a great example. So I guess what I'm trying to figure out is how does this industry push your button? What drives you to do this?
I really get a rush from it. It's fun. It's something that I like the industry of influence and attention. That's one of the things I'm passionate about, and just being ahead of influence and attention is what really drives me currently.
So do you think, like, I mean, you're still obviously really young, so you'll probably kind of evolve a little bit, but do you see this stream or type of marketing continuing to grow? Or do you think that at some point it's saturated? Because, you know, what you're doing right now is taking Tobias and whomever else, you know, you're working with, and you're saying, okay, here's a brand that matches your persona, or vice versa, you know?
Right.
And so, you know, you're really using celebrities or influencers, if you will, to help push a brand. Is this something that you see yourself doing 10 years from now? Is this something you see yourself just doing for the next 5 years, and it will evolve?
Definitely. I'm always looking for ways to innovate. But, you know, for now, eyes are shifting from the television to mobile.
Sure.
And there's $200 billion of ad spend in television space that's going to move to mm-hmm. mobile. So obviously the influence in the social channels are what everybody's looking at. And those are the faces of the influencers, or the engagement mm-hmm. of the influencers. So I don't think that's going anywhere. Anytime soon, at least.
Do you concern yourself with your partnerships? Like, I mean, are you concerned with, like, whom you represent and partner with different brands, or? Yeah.
Oh, I'm very particular. I won't. I get a million inbound requests a day, and I don't just jump on the dollar. It's really about aligning myself with mm-hmm. the right brands and with the right individuals.
Man, I just love your focus. And I mean, you said it already because you know it, but like your confidence and like your cool ass demeanor. I wish I had a third of that.
Thank you.
So I think that bodes well in a space that has a lot of money being thrown around, that if you can't keep your head on straight, I would imagine it could create some bad choices and bad connections, right. And bad brands to partner with at the end of the day. So. Yep. So listen, you've been super awesome with your time, and I really appreciate it. So
I
have one last question. I ask everybody this. You cannot get off until I ask this question, no matter what. So Marcus, for where you're at and what you're doing, how do you define happiness?
I think happiness is, you know, for me, I'm a family person. So if I can look over at my parents and my siblings and my wife and my kids and all my siblings' kids and see that they're happy, I'm successful.
Well, that is also, by the way, a great answer because it's short and sharp. So Marcus, it's not paradigm, I say it wrong. Marcus Damas.
Damas.
I knew it. Damn it. Second time I did it. Come on, say it if I said it that way. Marcus Damas. Thank you for your time, your energy, and your willingness to sit down with me on Executives After Hours.
James, thanks, man. I appreciate it.
And that's it. That's Marcus. I'm not even going to say his last name now because I'm totally petrified and then I'm going to screw it all up. So anyhow, go find him, Fueled by Culture. He's an incredibly chilled out dude, so chilled out. All right, follow me, Facebook, Twitter, at Executives A Hour. My Facebook is Executives After Hours as well. You can also find me on Instagram at Dr. James K. And just go to my website, subscribe. All right, man, I will see you and talk to you in a few days. Take care. See you.